The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what is a hobby, and what is an illegal stockpile of weapons?
If a military force of whatever sorts came to my house to try to take this from a different country or what have you, I need to have the right to protect myself too. If I don't have this, I can't protect myself. And it does also protect the rest of the rights.
That's the voice of someone who describes himself as a defender of the Constitution, claiming on the internet he has a right to train shooters and maintain an arsenal of weapons as part of his Second Amendment rights. Coming up, we will try to determine if such militia activists invite radicals like the shooters in San Bernardino to amass the firepower to do what they did last week, killing 14 innocent people. But first, let's remind ourselves what Donald Trump said yesterday as he continued to make a political opportunity out of the recent San Bernardino shootings.
We have to stop the Muslims until we find out what's going on. Does that make sense, by the way? Until we find out.
Stop the Muslims. Trump shrieking like a crusader priest from the Middle Ages at a rally in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina.
Our country cannot be the victim of horrendous attacks by people that believe only in jihad.
But this is not the Middle Ages. This is the 2016 presidential campaign, and Donald Trump has staked out a position once again that will distinguish him from the rest of the GOP field, strains credulity, and makes another bet that he will gain supporters from this gambit. And of course, there's always the chance that Donald Trump actually thinks this is a good idea. Nawa Arsala is a third-year law student at American University in Washington, D.C. What's your impression from this rhetoric, just hearing it straight off the top of your head?
I can tell you that last night I was on my way to watch the terrible upset between the Redskins and the Cowboys, and my brother is on his phone, and he reads this to me, and I start lecturing him, and I say, you know, you can't believe everything you read on Facebook. You have to check the source. And he's like, no, Nawa, this is from CNN. Read this article. It was so outrageous that I absolutely just did not believe it at first. It's almost like Mr. Trump doesn't want to be president.
Well, except there were people cheering there in South Carolina. How does that make you feel?
I think that's what shocked me the most. When I see that he's one of the front runners of the election, that's what shocks me the most, that my fellow Americans can identify with his sentiments and sympathize with it.
He acts as though, and again, I'm trying to keep an open mind about this, but he acts as though this is no big deal, that we just are going to have a moratorium on Muslims coming into the United States. But practically speaking, think about your family and your friends. What impact would this have on your lives, even if it was for just a couple of months?
This would have a terrible impact. For one, you know, I have so many family and friends that go to do the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. And for two, I work with several nonprofit organizations in Afghanistan where they bring some Afghan girls to America to do programs where they would study here and engage in some sort of education that they wouldn't be able to have in Afghanistan. And I have another program that I'm working with that brings artisans from Afghanistan to America. And these are invaluable educational programs that they won't be able to have in Afghanistan.
And of course, this is not an impact that's real at this point. This is just rhetoric. So you're just sort of imagining things that you would suddenly have to think about that you never had to think about before. You have family out of the country?
I do.
And they would suddenly have to think about this. Where are they from? In Afghanistan?
Yes, I have family in Afghanistan. And if they come to visit, you know, oftentimes they would come maybe once or twice a year just to see family here because we have so much family. But they've never had to worry about that before. And even my family that lives here, when they go back to Afghanistan, they've never had to worry about, will I be able to come back to America?
All right. On the other side, you know, it's not rhetoric, but clearly Trump is reacting to what happened in San Bernardino.
Mm-hmm.
I have Muslim friends who, when something like this happens, there's a kind of an internal uh-oh that goes off in their hearts. And, you know, it's not let's ban Muslims from coming into the country, but does your uh-oh meter go off when San Bernardino happens? And is this the kind of thing that you fear when something like that happens out in California?
Absolutely. I remember when as things were unfolding, I that's the first thought that comes to mind. I'm like, God, please don't let it be a Muslim, you know? And then lo and behold, still in my eyes, these people are not Muslim. But that is the kind of thing that we fear. And I think that, you know, President Obama said it perfectly the other night, that excluding Muslims and creating these databases, or to push as far as Mr. Trump says, to not let Muslims into the country, is exactly what these terrorists want.
Finally, Trump says these people who believe only in jihad. There are people who suggest that the two shooters in San Bernardino were espousing is some perverted form of Islam. You would say it differently, yes?
Absolutely. I'm far from an Islamic scholar, but I majored in Islam. And for 4 years, I tried to understand what that term jihad even means. And yes, there is, you know, some sort of physical interpretation of that. But in reality, it's a more of a mental everyday, a struggle of jihad. It's a struggle with my ego, a struggle to become a better person. This sort of interpretation is nothing that I learned in the 4 years that I studied under American scholars, Arab scholars, Afghan, Iranian, so many different scholars, that none of them had this idea. So I don't know where this radicalization came from, but it is something that absolutely needs to be addressed and can't be politicized by people like Mr. Trump.
And even Tashmin's encounter with the Al-Huda movement, which you know about, right?
Yes.
Which is a women's movement, which is very, very conservative and mm-hmm. very, very orthodox. And you would wear the full hijab. I wouldn't even see your face if we were talking face to face. They say this has nothing to do with them.
Yeah, this is, I mean, even Al-Qaeda says ISIS is too extreme for us. And in Afghanistan, the Taliban says, no way, ISIS is too extreme. This is not Islam. So even the most extremists of Muslims that we thought we saw don't even see them as Muslim.
Now, Arsala is a third-year law student at American University in Washington, D.C., thinking about what Donald Trump told an audience in South Carolina this week. Thanks so much, Nawa.
Thank you, John.
Now let's get to the shooters in San Bernardino who are being described as longtime radicals by federal investigators. Both Syed Rizwan Farooq and his wife Tashmin Malik had been planning for a deadly attack for months, investigators say now. They went to target ranges to practice shooting in the days leading up to the attacks. When the married couple were shot and killed by police last week, they were found to have two AR-15 assault rifles, 2,500 rounds of rifle ammunition on them. Their apartment revealed bomb-making equipment and more weapons. Last August, three North Carolina men were arrested and charged with weapons violations in Gaston County near Charlotte. The men were allegedly stockpiling weapons and bombs in preparation for a battle with the U.S. government they believed was imminent. They had long-range rifles, handheld radios, Kevlar helmets, and vests. How do the feds regard people who over time collect large amounts of firepower? Laws vary from state to state on the issue of stockpiling. Michael Sullivan was director of the ATF, or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, from 2006 to 2009. He joins me now. Michael, what is this stockpiling issue here? Is it precise?
No, I don't think it's precise at all, John. The federal government essentially doesn't look at the number of weapons that somebody is purchasing lawfully and using legally. But obviously, if they uncover during the course of an investigation a conspiracy to do harm, whether that's the more traditional violent crime or, in this particular case, an act of terrorism against the United States, then they take steps to try to prevent that from happening.
Is there a trigger, a threshold, an amount of weapons that you can get, a trigger which allows investigators to pay attention to what's being bought at commercial outlets?
No, I think that would be extremely arbitrary in and of itself. And, you know, though for some people it may sound like it's enhancing public safety, it would really do very little to do that. You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, almost 100% of the people that have multiple firearms have no intent to use those firearms illegally or in any acts of terrorism. So the thought of targeting 100% of the people to find that proverbial needle in the haystack seems to me to be a wasted effort and tremendous resources that candidly should be used in other ways to try to prevent, you know, the horrific acts that happened out in California.
Well, ATF and FBI didn't think it was wasted effort to go after these North Carolina men in August. I'm wondering what
Those
the distinction
facts.
Would be between them and their stockpiling and what happened in San Bernardino.
Well, I think the difference there are the facts. I mean, the ATF and the FBI essentially learned of a conspiracy in advance of the party's ability to essentially accomplish that. and law enforcement attempts to prevent incidences from happening. Likewise, had they learned during the course of any type of intelligence gathering that the Farids posed a serious threat to others, they would have intervened in a much earlier stage.
What would constitute a conspiracy? Talking at a shooting range? What sort of thing would constitute a conspiracy?
Well, certainly I would imagine if the law enforcement agency or if a private citizen overheard conversations that appeared that somebody was planning such a violent act, against the United States in terms of a terrorist incident or a criminal act in terms of the other organizations, that they would open up a criminal case and identify ways to intervene long before the events unfolded. As I understand it, Saeed Farooq purchased two of the handguns legally. I mean, there's a question about the long guns as to whether or not they were purchased legally. If the federal government learned during the course of either intelligence gathering that may have come as a result of looking at Tashmeen, prior to coming into the country or while she was here, if they had that information, they could have used that to open up a criminal case, and likely prevented it. I mean, that's the purpose of the intelligence gathering, is to see whether you can prevent such a horrific act.
Finally, and we've got to go in a moment here, but you go on the internet, right, and see these sites that talk about plots against the U.S. government and they're going to take over and we have to arm up and get ready for the end of days. Does that worry you about conspiracies? And are Muslims and radicalized Muslims like these people in San Bernardino invited to do the same sorts of things?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think you could suggest that an internet posting of somebody that does not have confidence that their Second Amendment constitutional rights are going to continue to be protected by this government as some future government of the United States essentially, motivates, somebody who's been radicalized in terms of, their particular faith to do such a horrific act. I see them as mutually exclusive.
Michael Sullivan is acting director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives from 2006 to 2009, currently an attorney with the Ashcroft Law Firm. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks, John.
The Chicago Police Department is adding a chapter to its history that began in the 1960s when black activists were killed by police, a shooting that was covered up by the CPD. Two fatal incidents in 1999 involved Chicago police and African-American motorists that inflamed charges of racism in the CPD, even though the officers in those cases were black. Now, the Federal Justice Department has announced an investigation into the death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, captured on video. McDonald is seen walking, then jogging away from several police vehicles in the moments before officers opened fire on him in October of last year.
It was horrible. It was surreal. The smoke puffs coming from the body.
The video has become a symbol of a tangible reality for Reverend Marshall Hatch, pastor of the new Mount Pilgrim Missionary Baptist Church on Chicago's west side.
How it became most egregious to me was to find out the background of the kid, to find out that he was a ward of the state, being murdered by an officer of the state in a public place, that the kid had such a tragic life and then such a tragic death. It touched you to the core of your being. And so I think a lot of us feel very passionate about justice for Laquan McDonald, at least give him a fair shake in death that he didn't get in life.
Questions. How much did Mayor Rahm Emanuel and top city officials know about the case from the get-go? Earlier this month, Emanuel fired Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. But the Justice Department will have many questions for the mayor and the police department in what it is calling a broad investigation into systems that potentially sustain racism in the city of Chicago. Alexa Van Brunn is attorney at the MacArthur Justice Center and clinical professor of law at Northwestern University. Alexa, how important is this Justice Department investigation in looking back at the history of the Chicago police going back to the 1960s?
It's essential, John. I hear what Reverend Hatch was saying about the Laquan McDonald shooting, and it is absolutely abhorrent. But what is real about that shooting is that it's a tip of the iceberg in Chicago when it comes to police violence, the culture of impunity and the code of silence that permeates the department, and which has done, as you say, since the 1960s. So if this investigation by the DOJ is done right, it has the possibility of really turning around a culture that is pervasive throughout the department.
Now, I'm not a lawyer, but if you look at the Fred Hampton case in the 1960s, this was a Black Panther activist in a shooting incident that was covered up by the Chicago Police Department. And the Panthers were in Chicago as part of a whole political confrontation with the white political machine in Chicago. Then in the 90s, you've got the driving while black incidents two motorists, both African-American. And now you've got the Laquan McDonald case. It seems that the institutional racism, for lack of a better word, in Chicago seems to have evolved from something that's very politically motivated to something that's much more casual in the driving while black cases in the 90s to something that is really on the street and in your face to individuals who are just walking the street innocently like Laquan McDonald was.
Well, I'm not sure. I think the kind of institutional racism that is exemplified by McDonald has been around for a very long time. I mean, between 2010 and 2014, we had 70 fatal shootings by the Chicago Police Department, and most of those don't make headlines.
I'm speaking with Alexa Van Brunn, attorney at the MacArthur Justice Center at Northwestern University. This is The Takeaway. Is DOJ late in the sense that all these years have passed this sense of tension between the police and the black community in Chicago through a couple of generations now?
Well, better late than never. But I have to say that it's not as if Chicago's communities have been standing by while this has happened. Chicago has an extremely strong civil rights litigation bar and has been obvious by the McDonald incident, the black youth groups and other organizing groups have made a tremendous difference in the way that this incident came to the public attention. They were really instrumental, and I think in blowing up the issue, and probably is a very strong reason why McCarthy ended up resigning. So while the DOJ is welcome, and yes, probably some kind of intervention would have been useful, years ago, there's been a lot of movement by a lot of different players in the Chicago community around this issue of police violence, institutional racism, and the code of silence in CPD.
Is the clock ticking here? Does DOJ have to do this quickly and issue a report, as was the case in Ferguson? Or is this going to be something much more long-term and carefully done with the idea that there will be indictments at the end of this?
Well, I can't guess what DOJ has in mind, but Ferguson took 6 months, and Ferguson is for the investigation, and Ferguson is much smaller than Chicago. The scope of this investigation, as indicated by Attorney General Loretta Lynch, is wide in breadth, which I applaud, and I think many activists and civil rights lawyers also applaud. We're looking at use of force, including use of deadly force, racism in policing, and then also accountability measures, which are incredibly important. And these implicate many agencies within the city. So while, yes, we think the investigation should not drag on by any means, it also has to be a real investigation. It has to get the buy-in from all different community groups, including those organizers who really brought it about in the first place. And the youth groups who know so much about what policing is in Chicago. And so in order to conduct an effective investigation, it likely will take a long time, and I presume longer than the Ferguson investigation did. And whether it will lead to indictments, I can't say at this point. We'll have to stay tuned.
Alexa Van Brunn is an attorney at the MacArthur Justice Center and clinical professor of law at Northwestern University. Alexa, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Later this hour, as the Supreme Court weighs the value of affirmative action, we're hearing from you. What is the value of diversity in the classroom?
Hey, this is Anna from Charlotte, North Carolina. My school growing up was the product of busing, and so it was a very diverse experience. Unfortunately, now in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school area, busing has been removed and kids go to neighborhood schools, which inevitably means less diversity. And I think that's a disadvantage.
San Jose, California. I lucked out and went to a high school which had a lot of Muslim students because the local private Islamic middle school sent most of its children there. The principal allowed us to take sixth period off on Fridays to attend prayer. We always want to hear from you. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
A look now at a visa program that's controversial, but not related to incidents of terrorism in the U.S. In the immigration debate, workers are permitted to enter the United States under what's called the H-2 guest worker program. Every year, 150,000 foreign workers enter the U.S. legally on H-2 visas. Employers may hire unskilled foreign workers when no qualified Americans can or will do the job. H-2 is the legal path, but it may become a way for U.S. employers to discriminate against U.S. workers. A new BuzzFeed News investigation says H-2 workers have built-in advantages over Americans, and employers seem to be exploiting them. Jessica Garrison is the co-author of All You Americans Are Fired. She says employers are required to prove that they tried to get U.S. workers, but there are all kinds of tricks.
We had companies, for example, that needed jobs in North Dakota and placed ads for those workers. Not in North Dakota, but in Iowa. Mm. And we had companies that said they needed housekeepers with, you know, a month of experience, and then told the government, you know, we didn't get any applicants that had a month of experience. But when the government followed up, they talked to people who had applied for these jobs and were turned away from them and said, I don't know what you're talking about. I have 20 years of experience as a housekeeper, but they weren't hired. And then we had cases where companies just got American resumes that seemed perfect for the job they were applying for, and they just never called them back. And then there were cases where Americans were hired, but they couldn't keep the job. And they said that they were fired almost immediately, and zero to few guest workers were ever terminated under the same terms.
Let's just turn the argument around for a moment, and regardless of the rules of the H-2 program for just a second. Do the companies have a point that the workers that they would prefer to use are outside of the United States for a variety of reasons, wages, reliability, et cetera?
I mean, I think there's a question of what do employers want and what does the law say, right? So I think employers, in many cases, the workers who come from Mexico, they come here without their family. They are incredibly motivated for these jobs because even though they're being paid very little by our standards, they make 10, 20, 30 times what they could make at home. And they desperately want to come back year after year after year. They're incredibly motivated, number one. Number two, they basically live where they work. So they're not really going to call in sick. They're not going to say, hey, I can't make it today because of X, Y, or Z. They are going to be there every single day, incredibly motivated. And finally, if they lose their job, they lose their permission to be in this country. So they're going to do everything they can to keep the job and please the boss.
Do you think employers take advantage of the incentives that exist for foreign workers on H-2 visas in that they can quite easily cross the line into exploitation?
I mean, certainly I would hate to make a blanket statement about all employers, but what we found with a previous investigation is that many do, that workers are not paid for all the hours they worked, that they are working around the clock, that they don't, you know, these are people who do not understand American labor laws. And so if they're told to work 13 hours a day, they might not know that they're entitled to overtime. They have no idea that they're entitled, for example, to workers' comp if they get injured. We found people in Mexico when we went to Mexico who had just horrific injuries, and we said, well, did you get workers' comp? And they looked at us like, what is that? So certainly I think there are many employers, although of course not all in this program, who do take advantage of their workforce in some way.
Do you think the H-2 visas are being abused and should be phased out? Is there a fix here, do you think?
I think that the question of whether it should or shouldn't be phased out is a complicated economic question. And as folks at the Department of Labor will tell you, it's part of a larger question having to do with immigration reform that is a protracted mess in Washington.
Jessica Garrison is a BuzzFeed News reporter. Her newest investigative piece, co-authored by Ken Bensinger and Jeremy Singer-Ving, is called All You Americans Are Fired. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
As the U.S. Supreme Court prepares to hear oral arguments in a case regarding the University of Texas and its use of racial preferences in undergraduate admissions, are university officials constrained in the way they can talk about race? Columbia University President Lee Bollinger says he's lived with these constraints and he's not happy about it.
It has resulted in a vague, generalized, somewhat empty conversation across the country, I think, as university administrators speak very abstractly about the benefits of racial and ethnic diversity.
The 1978 case Regents of the University of California versus Bakke originally struck down the use of racial quotas in university admissions and said that affirmative action could only be used to create and sustain diversity on campus, not to redress historical discrimination. In 2003, the justices reaffirmed that decision in a case known as Grutter versus Bollinger, with Bollinger as defendant when he was president of the University of Michigan. Bollinger spoke to us about how the court's legalistic approach to diversity on campus has distorted, in his view, how we understand America's troubled racial history.
If you look at the sort of arc of history, go back to Plessy versus Ferguson, and the Supreme Court upholds Jim Crow laws in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, that really unleashes a huge civil rights movement across the country. Affirmative action policies were adopted by every university in the country to try to advance integration. It, really, in the 1970s, those were adopted, and other institutions as well, including the military. Then we went through a period, really, of almost ahistorical amnesia about what we were doing with the Brown versus Board of Education. Now it has resurfaced as a major issue still for America. We see it in our public school system, which remains segregated in many, many states. We see it in our criminal justice system. I think we're at a moment where, once again, we are feeling the weight of history and the work ahead on civil rights and equality.
You've argued for a new Brown versus Board of Education decision in the sense that it would clarify or potentially, I guess you would hope that it would clarify this question of intentional versus de facto segregation and the harm that it causes to society, harm that we are experiencing, and there's really no debate about that, but the question of what redress there is a constitutional issue. How do you think that case could possibly happen?
I think the one thing that is clear is that we have a history of the past half century that we can be very proud of as a nation, beginning with the really landmark decision in Brown versus Board of Education, all the very important legislation about voting and against discrimination that came out of the 1960s. I think we have done more on trying to overcome discrimination and a century or more of slavery than any other country in the world. But how we talk about it, I think, is not really consistent with that. There was a fateful moment in 1978 when the first affirmative action policy of the University of California at Davis was considered by the Supreme Court. And in that decision, Justice Powell said that affirmative action for purposes of educational benefits is constitutional, but universities and colleges cannot consider affirmative action as a basis for remedying the past history of slavery and discrimination. There are a variety of theories that have been given for why that distinction was made, but it has resulted in a vague, generalized conversation across the country, I think, as university administrators speak very abstractly about the benefits of racial and ethnic diversity. While, in fact, our whole society is still struggling with trying to overcome the legacies of the slavery and the official and other discrimination in the society.
Do you think that the way the courts have argued this and the way they are, as you say, possibly inconsistent from the way America needs to be thinking about this right now, that university presidents are left with the situation where if there is a disparity, a racial disparity, on campus, and I'm thinking of possibly the University of Missouri case situation really in the last couple of months, that presidents are forced to basically say, you're stuck with this because that's the way it is, that essentially it is not our mission here at this university to aggressively redress issues that we see in society that are unjust, whether it's higher education or anything else, and that's a position you're forced to take by the way the courts have ruled.
I think what we're seeing on American campuses now is a part of what we're also seeing in the broader society. So when you really do look closely at our public K through 12 system, I think it's fairly shocking how segregated so many school systems remain after all this time, and in some cases more segregated than it was in 1960 or even at the time of Brown. And I think when we see issues of criminal justice and how it's applied to African Americans and Hispanics and other underrepresented minorities, and when we see the income divide and when we see the efforts over time that have really made for a kind of stagnant opportunities for so many people in the society. So when you look at all that, I think it's easy for young people to become very frustrated and not to see a society that is openly and honestly addressing what it is that they're facing. I think a number of the ways in which this has manifested itself on campuses is misguided. But I think that as a society, we really have not been in the practice of continuing to address these issues of race and ethnicity and the history. I think that's partly because of the way the court has structured the permissible arguments that you can use to support affirmative action.
Lee Bollinger, thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thank you, John.
Lee Bollinger is the president of Columbia University. Diversity in the classroom. What was your school like growing up? How has it changed over time? From Cleveland, Ohio, my high school, Lincoln West High, was the ultimate in diversity. It was chosen by the president to visit when he came to the city of Cleveland in the 70s. Even today, they have a Nationality Day where they celebrate all the various ethnic groups.
Hi, my name is Kate McHale, and I'm calling in from Colorado Springs. My high school had the majority minority, and the separation between the races was pretty stark. Now that I'm in a college that is over 75% white, seeing the separation between the races is maybe even starker here than in my high school. I'm fairly disturbed. I'm beginning to realize how negatively that can affect one's surroundings and mental health.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Tell us a story at thetakeaway.org. Maya Lin is an artist who works well in clay, bronze, and paint, but perhaps prefers bulldozer.
I see them at that scale. They're your hands. And you find these earth movers, and they literally are, with massive equipment, literally sculpting the earth the way I would sculpt a clay model.
These days, the creator of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, who won a design competition while she was still a student at Yale, is looking back and forward at her body of work and at planet Earth. They're related, she says. Her Confluent site installations are built across 438 miles in two states. Her waveform sculptures of land as water can be seen in Michigan, New Zealand, and New York State. The new book, Maya Lin Topologies, is a retrospective of her work. It's also filled with words and essays that describe her intent, whether she is sculpting in the studio or carving up the land to show her love for it.
You know, I think the earthworks, and there have been three waves, and then I just completed a couple years ago my largest of the earthworks for a private art compound in New Zealand, a fold and a field. Those have got to be pure joy to have worked on, to run over, to imagine, and then to go play in the earth at the scale.
The notion of berm and the sheltering that land can provide when it's shaped properly is there from the very beginning. It's in your description of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that you would descend into the memorial and that it would become a quiet place. You understood instinctively that would be the case. That would be the result of that sculpturing.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing because you only go down 10 feet. So even though you're going down and the sounds disappear, what's actually happening as you walk in is you feel the names are rising up. any deeper and you would have actually felt like what the critics said at the time. It's a pit. It's a negative space. But instead, what it did was it gave you sanctuary, and yet it actually elevates and makes the soldiers' names rise up. So there's a very interesting sort of psychological response to that piece that's both a little bit, you know, it quiets. I'll never forget, I was there, you know, soon after it opened, and there was this really noisy group of school kids, and boom, they hit the beginning of it, they start walking down. Teacher doesn't have to say anything. They just all quiet down. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting mix of I always bring it to the analogy. It's like Orpheus descending, and then you get to the bottom, you get to the apex, and then you have to turn around and walk back up into the light. But in a funny way, you don't feel you've gone down that far. It's literally the names are rising up.
I want to close an arc here in my own life. I've never spoken to you about this, but there's a picture in your book of the crowd on dedication day of all those people in black and white just sort of crowded in, and it was such an amazing moment. And I was there. I'm not in the picture, but it was an amazing crowd that was there, and I remember in a wheelchair sort of negotiating my way to the front and just seeing the effect of precisely what you've described, descending into a rising cascade of names. It was so deeply moving, and you understood immediately that this connected, this completely connected. And I thought to myself, wow, that someone could have anticipated all of this. And of course you didn't, but you're an artist, so you say, let this go and we'll see what happens. And so much happened.
Well, I think the only thing I did know, and I think the veterans asked me before it was built, how are people going to feel? And I didn't say. I said, people are going to cry. People are going to have to overcome their loss, and they have to mourn. And I think that's fundamental. I think we tend to look at death and loss, and we almost put it away in a box. And the minute you do that, you can't overcome the grief. So if you face it, and then you have to turn around and walk back into the light, it's going to bring up all the repressed emotions that were partially hidden because of the nature of that war. Veterans came back. They had to take responsibility for being the soldiers that went to that war. You know, whether they were screamed at, yelled upon, it was a very confrontational moment. And they had to own it like no other soldier has had to. And I think America at that time just bottled it all up until this piece. And so it's all going to come out to the surface. But I didn't say that to the veterans at the time.
Do you feel as though understanding the power of art that early on gave you an advantage in some of your later work?
Absolutely. What's been the discovery of the kind of the arc of developing who your voice really is? I'm an artist. I'm very committed to the buildings, but I tend to approach the world through an artist's point of view. It's, you know, my dad was dean of fine arts. I was probably casting bronzes before I got through high school. I made everything I could possibly make and continue to do so today. I mean, I feel like as an artist, sometimes you don't have a choice. You're following your instincts. And art is inherently a fairly, you know, there is something very narcissistic about wanting to just make something because you need to make it, because you want to see it, because you want to touch it. And that has been what I've always done.
Violin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Violin is an artist, architect, and memorialist. The new book, Violin Topologies, is a retrospective of her work. We'll have more on Violin later in the month when we look at her environmental concerns and the ways she feels art can change the state of the earth for the better. And thinking about the events of our times, 35 years ago today, a black Charter Arms 38 caliber pistol changed the world. Mark David Chapman, after getting an autograph earlier in the day, pulled that gun on John Lennon outside the Dakota apartment building, shot him twice in the back and once in the shoulder. The gun cost $169, purchased at a shop in Hawaii and carried, presumably in his luggage, on his trip to New York City via Atlanta. That gun would be illegal in New York today. Back in 1981, there were 1,867 New Yorkers gunned down, including John Lennon. Last year, there were 328 murders. That was the lowest since records began. Lennon's death raised issues of mental illness, but Chapman pleaded guilty to the crime of shooting John Lennon and is serving a 20 years to life sentence in a prison in western New York. His parole was last denied in 2014. Imagine there's no Chapman. Imagine there's no Black Charter Arms 38 caliber pistol. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
War is big business, you know, and they like war because it keeps them fat and happy. And I'm anti-war, so they're trying to keep me out, but I'll get in, you know, because they'll have to own up in public that they're against peace, you know. Because violence begets violence, you know, and if you run around wild, you get smacked, and that's it, you know, that's the laws of the universe. And they've got all the weapons, they've got all the money, and they know how to fight violence because they've been doing it for thousands of years, suppressing us. And there's many ways of promoting peace. Do everything for peace. Kiss for peace, or smile for peace, or go to school for peace, or don't go to school for peace. Whatever you do, just do it for peace. It's up to the people. You can't blame it on the government and say they're doing this, they're going to put us into war. We put them there, and we allow it, you know, and we can change it. If we really want to change it, we can change it.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on art appreciation, accounting, auto repair, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Squarespace, providing tools to create a professional website. Learn more at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
PRI, Public Radio International.